third case for argument this morning is United States against Walker. Mr. Code, if that podium is a little low for you, you can just raise it. There's a switch on the right-hand side.
Those things are a little too low for me, so thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Code. I represent one of the appellants in this case today, Huron Walker. And I would ask, I checked with a clerk before I came in, and they have me slotted for just 3 minutes of arguments and two on rebuttal, and if I could just have the 5 minutes up front, I'd appreciate it. In this criminal case, the district court excused the principal accuser from testifying. The court allowed the admission of testimonial hearsay, and then barred the defense from calling the informant, the principal accuser, to challenge the truth of any of his statements or to challenge the accuser's credibility.
But Walker didn't object during the trial that the statements were offered for the truth of the matter and therefore fell outside the court's order. Nor did Walker call Ringwald to the stand. So how can Walker complain now?
Your Honor, prior to trial, there were simultaneous briefs filed, one by the government asking for the recordings to be admitted without the presence of the informant. At the same time, I think it was on the same day, I'd have to check the docket, the defense counsel for Walker filed a motion to produce the informant at trial. In the second section of that brief, prominently entitled Crawford Confrontation, argued that the informant should be produced. So I think, following those briefs, the district court entered a written order in which it did, as I said when I opened here, precluded Walker from challenging the truth of any statements made by the CI.
Can you identify with precision which of the statements were most objectionable, or are you really challenging all the statements by the confidential informant?
Sure. I can't stand here and say I challenge all of them, no. There was 100 minutes, by my count, of recordings played for the jury, narrated by the ATF agents who testified. That translates into 182 pages of transcripts, which were also given to the jury during deliberation at their request. So I can't say that all 100 minutes, but there are, if I may point to statements for each count, there are testimonial out-of-court statements that matter. First, for the first gun, which was recovered on April 27th.
You mean the 357?
The 357. The informant, unannounced to the ATF, brings it to the ATF's office and says, Huron Walker gave that gun to me. Agent Inlow testified that conversation happened, and he identified Huron Walker as the source of that gun based on that conversation. So that's the first one, and that wasn't on a recording.
Yeah, but there's a lack of objection, and there's other evidence tying Walker to that 357.
Two things there. I'll try to break that out. Counsel for Walker didn't have to object at trial. There was an unconditional order from the district court saying you can't challenge the truth of any statements and you can't attack his credibility.
No,
and Gaggio,
counsel, that doesn't seem to me an accurate description of the district court's order.
Yeah.
District court's order said that when statements are offered to show the context of the defendant's statements, you can't challenge them as hearsay. District court did not say, if out-of-court statements are offered for the truth of the matter stated, I will not accept an objection. District court didn't remotely say that. And, of course, we know in one of the trials that there were objections and they were sustained by the district court.
Well, I respectfully disagree based on Gaggio and the wording of the order.
So where did the district court say that if hearsay was offered for the truth of the matter stated rather than context, the defense, if they objected, would be at risk of being held in contempt or anything similar?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you were putting the cart before the horse a little bit, and I understand if you're focusing on a statement that wasn't a part of a recording, But the order.
Exactly. That's the problem in this case. There were some statements that were indeed offered to show the context of the defendant's statements in the recording, and some statements that were bona fide hearsay. And defense counsel doesn't seem to have drawn a distinction between them. That's the problem on appeal of forfeiture.
Well, I don't know that that's forfeiture. I think it's waiver. Or excuse me, it is forfeiture, which would require plain error review by this court. And I would say that it wouldn't survive on plain error anyways. But I disagree. I think that, you know, that's the only out-of-court statement that wasn't on a recording that I'm complaining of on appeal was for the first gun. For the second gun and to the conspiracy and the attempt, all those statements are on the recordings. One statement as to the second gun, the informant is talking on a cell phone to the ATF agent with Mr. Walker in the car, Mr. Logan in the back, says, I got one on me. I got another pistol. Those are testimonial statements offered for their truth at the trial, and my client's attorney could not challenge the truthfulness of those statements based on the pretrial ruling. I don't think they were offered for context. Those statements, I got one on me and I got another pistol.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry, if I meant. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Gaskins.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please forgive me. I am suffering from a cold, and so I'll do my best in terms of voice, and hopefully, prayerfully, it stays with me. May it please the Court, my name is Tanya Gaskins, and I represent one of the defendant appellants in this case, Rashad Logan. Since, Your Honor, we have very limited time, and it's two defendants, I'm actually going to limit my statements and rest on the brief for several things. I am going to focus on three points. The first is dealing with the Confrontation Clause. As Mr. Coed has already mentioned, and this Court clearly understands, my client actually did call the confidential informant. While that is the case, the order that stood prior to the trial and even the conversation during the trial did not take away from that existing order. There was some leeway given, and the Court was very specific in their conversation. They said there will be leeway given regarding one particular gun. It did not say that they were opening up testimony or questioning regarding every single fact that the hearsay was introduced regarding. Because of that, we still feel that the Confrontation Clause, my client's Confrontation Clause rights, his Sixth Amendment rights, were violated.
Clause have to do with this?
Well, Your Honor, he did not have.
A hearsay argument I understand, but the Supreme Court has said the Confrontation Clause is satisfied if the declarant is available, and we know, of course, that Ringswald was not only available, he was actually called in Logan's trial.
Your Honor,
you've got a hearsay problem, not a Confrontation Clause problem.
Your Honor, I feel that we actually have both. One problem that I was pointing to in terms of the Confrontation
Clause has held otherwise. So if you would just argue it in the terms that the Supreme Court says are valid, I think you'd be better off.
Yes, Your Honor. In turning to the hearsay portion of this, the information regarding the admission of the gun and several other factors that were omitted from Ringswall were clearly hearsay. We argue that. We objected to that.
But how can we find reversible error given that he confessed to his involvement in the conspiracy, and he also confessed that he knew his co-conspirator had the firearm?
Your Honor,
go
ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, he actually, there was a statement, and it wasn't a signed written confession. It was a summary from the ATF agents. I'm not saying that they did not make every attempt to accurately convey the information.
Well, I mean, basically that's called a confession.
No, I understand that, Your Honor. I'm just saying that these were not his words specifically that he signed off on. And, in fact, the statements do not say, he said that he knew that the gun was present and that he understood that they had it. That does not mean that the hearsay information that was permitted is still was validly and properly introduced. It's just saying that there was other evidence, but this particular evidence was not valid and should not have been introduced. In addition to a hearsay argument, I'd like to also argue that my client's due process rights were violated in that there were several errors that were committed during the course of his trial. They were vehemently objected to by counsel. They were repeatedly put down by the judge, and on several occasions the judge actually said, counsel, for the government, you're just admitting this for context, correct, and moved past it without actually asking for an argument from the government. Your Honor, this goes to fundamental fairness. He was not afforded the right to a fair and proper trial, and in that respect, we are asking for him to have a new trial. And my final point in terms of my client is that there was sentencing entrapment. And I understand, Your Honor, that in the Seventh Circuit, there is a difference between sentencing manipulation and sentencing entrapment. And sentencing entrapment is a valid principle in the Seventh Circuit.
Yeah, but doesn't the evidence indicate that your client actually tried to expand rather than restrict the scope of the robbery? He desired to expand it to include a cash and the drugs that were inside the home as well. And that surely, you know, would defeat a claim of sentencing entrapment.
Your Honor, I actually would like to say that I don't feel that that is the case. I think that his very limited involvement, and I'll explain why, I think that his very limited involvement and very limited conversation was just mere puffery, and he's
puffery?
He's actually kind of exaggerating and having a conversation with the other people that were involved, and that he was not necessarily trying to further the plan, because none of the things that he suggested were even taken under consideration or implemented.
Well, they may not have been taken under consideration, but he sure was throwing those ideas out.
I can see that that is the case, Your Honor. What I'd like to point to in terms of sentencing entrapment is the fact that he was a petty criminal. He had never committed any crime. He had four drug charges. He had never committed any crime to this extent. In fact, the highest amount of drugs that he ever had was, I believe, 15 grams.
He's pretty excited about having this stash.
And, Your Honor, and that's exactly what I'm pointing to. I'm pointing to the fact that the government made this such an enticing arrangement, and that's what sentencing entrapment looks to. They made it such an enticing arrangement that this petty criminal would depart from his normal pattern and pursue something that was clearly outside of the scope of what he was generally willing to do. As a result of the errors committed in Logan's trial, I respectfully request that Logan receive a new trial, or at the very least, Your Honors, that because of the sentencing issues, that he be remanded and resentenced. Thank you. It stayed around.
Thank you.
Mr. Otluski.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Pat Otluski on behalf of the United States. The main thrust of the defendant's argument today is this Confrontation Clause problem. And the Supreme Court laid it out very clearly in Crawford that there is no Sixth Amendment problem under the Confrontation Clause when a statement is offered for a non-hearsay purpose.
Yeah, but although the many statements, you know, are purportedly admitted to show context in some cases, isn't it the most direct evidence of the offense, specifically regarding the charge of possession of the .357 Magnum? Isn't there very little to tie Walker to the firearm other than the objectionable statements?
Your Honor, if we'll unpack that objectionable statement issue, there was Agent Bayless got up on the stand and testified that
right.
He received a firearm
from Ringwald.
Right. Actually, from
and
Bingham
that he
Lowe.
Understood that Walker had given it to Ringwald.
Right.
And I want to know how that statement is context as opposed to a statement that is offered for the truth of the matter. Look, if context is your goal, then the initial statement that Bayless got the firearm from Ringwald would be enough to establish the context so that we could understand the later reference to a .357 in the conversation with Walker. Why is the reference to Walker necessary except to establish that Walker is guilty of the underlying offense as well. I'm not getting it.
It's based on Agent Bayless's subsequent conversation with Hurrion Walker on April 30th, Your Honor. During that conversation, he brought up the fact that that Walker had dropped this .357 Magnum on Ringswald. And that's why he testified that it was his understanding that the gun had come from
Walker. Well, that's classic hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter stated. I think you would do better to focus on an argument for harmless error.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, Your Honor. And if we look at the evidence in this case, as the court mentioned during the defendant's argument, there Logan did confess. The evidence of Walker's involvement, both on the possession of the firearm, both firearm possession charges, as well as the drug conspiracy and attempt charges, was overwhelming in this case. They met for 4 hours on May 1st, 4 hours searching for a second firearm, 4 hours when they discussed both the gun that they were looking for and the other gun that Agent Bayless already had. They mentioned during that conversation the, quote, demonstration gun that Agent Bayless had on him that Walker had already handed over to him. And apart from that, we also have the lead up to this point, especially with Walker. He met twice with Agent Bayless, once on April 24th with Logan, with Ringswald. He met again on the 30th. It's Ringswald, Bayless, and Walker. Walker was excited about the opportunity to commit the crimes. He laid it out very clearly that that's what he was going to do. And the only reason the government brought up any of the cooperative statements was for context. Context.
You've got to study context down there.
Either that or you and the appellate staff have just got to purge the word context
From your vocabulary.
Well,
this is
hearsay
not
is an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter stated. If it's not offered for the truth of the matter stated, it's not hearsay. Maybe if you just got rid of the word context and focused on the definition of hearsay, you wouldn't be making this error.
Your Honor, I don't think we're committing error right here. What we're talking
about. But we do.
I understand, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the statements that were offered on the recordings.
If this is how you're thinking, it means you're committing this error frequently. And in some cases, it won't be harmless.
I apologize, Your Honor. If I can explain. The three recorded conversations, the informant statements were only offered for context for the defendant's own admissions. He was talking with them. He was a participant in those conversations.
No, that's not even the right meaning of context. When we have used that word, we have used that so that you've got this two-sided conversation, A and B. B is the defendant. B's statements are all admissible. To figure out what B's statements mean, you may need some other statements, because if A says something and B says, yeah, I agree, something like that, in order to see what B is saying, you need the rest. It's not that they're admitted for context in the sense that a literary scholar would refer to it. It's that they're admitted to show the meaning of the admissions by the party opponent. And they're admitted for the truth of that matter, too, because it's an admission by a party opponent. But that's not how the statement by Bayless that Ringswald told him he'd mm-hmm. got the gun from Walker was admitted.
Your Honor, Bayless never testified that Ringswald told him that he got the gun from Walker. That testimony was never elicited.
Hold on. Forgive me, but hold on. Bayless testifies that he received the .357 from Ringswald and that he understood that Walker gave the firearm to Ringswald. That's what happened here.
Yes, Your Honor. And as I mentioned before, Bayless's understanding was based on his subsequent conversation.
But it's not based on personal knowledge. It's not based on personal knowledge. It's based on what one guy tells another guy.
It's based on, no, Your Honor, when Bayless had that conversation with Walker, he's entering an area where he has personal knowledge. When he talks
Bayless
to...
Bayless didn't have the conversation with Walker. He had the conversation
with Ringswald.
And if it's now your position that Bayless got this information from someone other than Ringswald, then I don't understand what conceivable theory would make it admissible.
Oh, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that he obviously obtained the handgun from Ringswald.
He obtained the handgun from Ringswald. He got from someone or somewhere the belief that Ringswald got it from Walker. If The statement, if he got that belief from something Ringswald said, then we've got hearsay. If he got that belief from some unstated basis, you've made the statement inadmissible because there's no foundation for it. It's completely rests on air. So it's inadmissible one way or the other.
Well, there's
you can't say my witness so fuzzed up where he got the information that now it's admissible. It just means it's utterly, obviously inadmissible.
Your Honor, the testimony that was listed at a trial wasn't that Bayless his understanding came from Ringswald, and it wasn't that it came from some unnamed source.
Where did it come from?
His conversation with Hurrion Walker himself, when he said, I saw that 357 that you dropped on Ringswald. It's at that point that his understanding becomes very clear. And when Walker says to Bayless, yeah, you like that? I've got other automatics,
well,
too.
Yeah. Then your theory would be not that it's admitted for context, not that it was offered for something other than the truth of the matter stated, but it's offered as an admission of a party opponent. But that certainly wasn't your brief in this court. You weren't treating that statement as Walker's admission.
I apologize, Your Honor, if the brief wasn't clear on that point, but it was our understanding that the ATF's investigation...
It's not that it wasn't clear, it's that it wasn't there.
I understand, Your Honor. If I may, the way the government presented the case was that the ATF was pursuing an investigation, and part of it, obviously they're going to obtain a gun from one person and then have a subsequent conversation with one of the defendants to follow up and ensure that they could establish how that gun was obtained. And perhaps that's what I was referring to.
Subsequent conversation with Walker, as I recall, Bayless made a very shorthand reference to the 357. And, you know, the jury could not otherwise place that reference in context. Oh, I used the word.
Your Honor, I understand. But the thing is, when Bayless did bring that conversation up, when he did bring up that 357, Walker jumped. He jumped right out and said, man, you like that one? I also have other guns. I have automatics. But you know what? When someone sees a revolver...
Well, that's the other evidence, okay?
And that establishes...
You've got the other evidence.
Correct, Your Honor.
But, you know, we're dealing with a problem that I'm beginning to think is endemic downstairs.
Endemic in the sense that...
That you keep coming up here with the same arguments about context. And... You come awfully close to defendants not getting fair trials.
I understand, Your Honor. You know, to respond to one other point that the defendants did make, that they did make a confrontation clause objection in advance of trial. This is primarily Defendant Walker's argument. He relies on this Crawford argument that he makes in the production motion that he filed with the district court. That did not raise an objection that. He wanted to, that he was objecting to the government's use of the cooperator statements. It was simply to ensure that the government would produce the witness at trial. It had nothing to do with the testimony or the other out-of-court statements that were going to be offered. If there are no further questions from the court, I will rest on the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Coe, your time has expired. Anything further, Ms. Gaskins? All right. Well, Mr. Code, you can finish up on Ms. Gaskins this time.
Thank you, and I won't use it all. I just have one point to make on harmless error. The government did not raise harmless error in the brief. I didn't see the words. I didn't see an argument that resembled it. I think they've waived that argument.
Well,
and this court has held in Silva, an opinion written by Judge Easterbrook, that
it doesn't make any difference who writes the opinions of this court.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's more of a point of interest.
You're hurting Judge Flom's and my feelings.
I have, but I just want to quote it. You know, we declined to exercise our discretion to invoke harmless error doctrine on our own, and I think if the government's good at anything, they're really good at raising harmless error, and they didn't do it in this case, and I'd ask you not to raise it on your own. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and Mr. Code, Ms. Gaskins, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your clients.